Because it always gets a good reaction. I told several people at Ledge Conference, but I think I told you this. I was in the 5 a.m. cab for my 7 a.m. flight to D.C. You know, you never know what you're going to get with an Uber at that point, right? So the guy comes out and he's got like these checkered Vans on. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. You know, probably not serial killer material. But so we're in the car and we're chatting and stuff, you know, because you want to keep the killer on the line, right? Like you want to keep them talking. Yeah. Maybe they'll forget that they're going to kill you. And like, it's fine. And then all of a sudden there's like a 2-minute pause. And then out of nowhere, he goes, so do you have sensitive skin? Did I tell you this?
No.
I didn't tell you this? Yeah. He was like, mm-mm. So do you have sensitive skin? And I was like, this is how I die. Like, indeed, this is how I die. And I forget what I said, but he was like, you know, I've been looking for a good shampoo.
No, you never asked that question.
Yeah. Out of
Not
nowhere.
Not to a stranger. Yeah, that's that's Buffalo Bill type.
Exactly. It is. It's Buffalo Bill. Like, oh, because I'd like to know, you know, I want to make sure when I'm, you know, treating your skin after you've been flayed.
Five
Are you
stars?
Excited? Yeah. Five. Oh, yeah. I don't want that guy knows where I live. Of course, 5 stars.
Jen Litz on the line here. She is the director of content here at Beer Business Daily, and I'm Jordan Driggers, the editor here on the beer side of things. And today we are joined by Isaac Shawaki, the founder of Octopi Brewing. He has started this high-end beverage co-packer out of Wisconsin about a decade ago that has seen just phenomenal growth, and so much so that it caught the attention of one of the world's largest brewers, Asahi, who acquired Octopi at the start of this year. Thank you for joining us, Isaac.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So lots to get into, and I know you personally have quite the story to get to this point. And I hope we can get into a little bit of that. But, you know, I'd like to begin with the genesis of Octopi. You know,
sure.
a decade ago, craft is still in its golden years and everyone's opening craft breweries. But you exit the craft brewery, you helped found Chicago-based Five Rabbit Cerveceria and move on to open a contract brewery in Wisconsin, where there's already some big established contract brewers. So what did you see at the time and what kind of gave you confidence to pursue this path?
Yeah, for sure. No, thanks for that. So I'll go a little bit backwards. So I'm from Mexico and I have no idea how I ended up in Wisconsin, but but my first job out of university was with a top three consulting firm. So I did a lot of work for the CPG space, mainly beer. And that's how I got involved in beer. You know, we're working 100 hours a week at the site. You know, I was in breweries and I just fell in love with the beer industry and the breweries like right out of college. So I did that for 8.5 years. And then I moved to Chicago to open, it was at the time the first Latin microbrewery in the US. And I was in charge of contract. So I was in charge of looking for places to make our product. And long story short, it was awful. It was a horrible experience. I was working, you know, I thought I was going to work with one brewery and they're going to work with me and we're going to grow together. And before I knew it, I was working with 8 different breweries, anywhere from 10 barrels all the way to 300, 400 barrels per batch. And then quality was horrendous. No flexibility in packaging, no flexibility in formulations. Pricing was terrible. So everything was so bad. And I'm like, man, if I could do it again, I want to open a contract brewery that's going to be, you know, quality, quality, quality. And of course, customer service being for the client, et cetera. So I started as a client and I saw all the negative about contract brewing at the time. And I said, I could do it better. And that's literally how the idea for Octopi started.
And why Wisconsin?
I was in Chicago for my first stint. I knew the Midwest market very, very well. So I wanted to stay in the Midwest. My wife is the smart one. She's a doctor. So I told her, May, wherever you get the job, I'll move. I really want to stay in the Midwest. However, Wisconsin, you know, we have the lowest beer tax in the nation, along with Missouri for obvious reasons. A lot of the major suppliers for equipment, you know, they're German, but their North American headquarters are in Wisconsin because of the dairy industry in the 60s. So like KHS, Krones, et cetera, were here. Amazing beer, you know, history. And then a lot of the supplies, also raw materials are here, you know, Malt Euro, Breeze, et cetera. They're all here in Wisconsin. So there's a lot of good things about Wisconsin that made perfect sense for the business. And that's where we chose it. But at the end of the day, like if my wife didn't get the job here, I wouldn't have moved because she was going to pay the bills for a long time.
Okay. So you opened Octopi in 2015, and I think it's relatively tiny, right? It was about 10,000 barrels that first year.
Yeah, so the year we started, we had six employees, including myself, so five plus me, 16,000 square feet, and we did over 10,000 barrels the first year. That was the numbers for the first year.
Okay, and then, tell us a little bit about the evolution of the company. Because I know you kind of started out primarily contracting craft, but when did you begin to take on other segments, and what were some like big milestones of growth along the way?
Yeah, for sure. So literally the year I started with craft because that's what I knew. And we started with craft only, but literally like the first year I opened, I said, craft is going nowhere. Craft is dying. I need to change the strategy if I need to, if I want to continue growing. So literally after opening, I said, like, I need to redo the whole business plan. And we've expanded every single year. We've grown 70% year over year for 9 years straight. So it was 70% year growth. So it's been crazy growth for manufacturing. But the first year I said it's dying. I went to the bank that has been a great partner. And I'm like, hey, I have this idea. Remember, you just gave me a ton of money. I'm going to ask you for way more money. My numbers are look good, but I need to buy a lot of equipment that can do any beverage. So after the first year, by 2017, 2018, we became a beverage co-packer. After that, big expansion was done. And we bought flash pasteurizers, inline carbonators, batching systems, like all the equipment that you need to do more like batching, like sodas, energy drinks, etc. And 2017, 2018, I changed from contract brewer to beverage co-packer. And then also at that time, out of kind of nowhere, we started attracting really, really large clients. They're like, oh, we heard you just put this kind of equipment. We're interested in trying some stuff, and that's how kind of like we got started with bigger clients. And we started doing a lot of their innovation work. And then fast forward, when we opened, we're 100% beer. We're 95% of our packaging was in glass because our first packaging line was glass. And we were only focused on craft beer. Today, 20% of our production is beer and it's declining. That's going to change with Asahi, but it's 20% of our production. 97% of our production is cans. Glass is 2%. And we work with, I would say, the biggest beverage companies in the world, both alcoholic, non-alcoholic. So completely different business. We've been able to change as we go really quickly, but it's been the right moves. A lot of challenges along the way, but it's been a fantastic ride.
I wanted to jump back to, that initial year when you kind of saw that craft was dying, as you said. What did you see? Because I don't, the trends hadn't really like, hit a complete wall by then, right? So what told you that this segment was kind of flattening out?
No, you did see the trends. When we opened the first brewery in Chicago, like, the craft beer was still growing double digits, but high double digits. And then it went, we went from like 100, 150% to 70% to 20% to 10% to single digits. So you clearly, if you were following, you were seeing those trends really dramatically going down. Very similar to what happened with hard seltzer, crazy growth, plateaued down, and then RTD, same thing. And of course, there's always like one or two leaders, but the trends were there. But the numbers of brewery openings were not there. They were still going crazy. They were opening 300, 400 breweries every year, which at that time I thought they were insane numbers. And today it's still like, why are people still opening so many breweries when the numbers are not there anymore? So yeah, I saw that and I just literally saw like, okay, how many openings? Very few closings. The growth of the category was completely in decline. It was growing, but the growth was declining. So I saw that. I'm like, hey, if I don't jump ship from here, I'm not going to go anywhere. My growth was going to be very limited.
And then you were talking about now you work with some of the largest, beverage companies, both alcoholic, non-alcoholic.
Yes.
When did it or did it ever cross your mind that what you had built would be attractive to a large supplier?
Yeah, for sure. Like I always said since the beginning, like if there's a good offer on the table, I'll take it. But that's for everything, not just for selling the business. Like if there's a good project, I will never say like, no, we can't do this. It's more like, let me learn more and then I'll tell you if I can do it or not. And that's how we take every project. Like, if there's a big or small company and they come like, we want a co-pack, we'll rarely say no to the first meeting just to learn more. And then we can think if it's good for us or not. And the same thing I thought, like if there's somebody interested in the business, I would always take a meeting. And if it's interesting enough to keep going, let's keep going to see what happens. But the real one was like, so I've, like I said, I grew to like 250,000 barrels, which was about like 3 million cases at the time. And I'm like, at the time, I was still relatively pretty big for craft, but pretty small in the world of manufacturing. And I really still had a lot of business, a huge pipeline. So that's when I took a huge plunge and I did a very large expansion, like a $70 million expansion. I went from 250,000 barrels to 1 million barrels. And even though today I'm still considered mid-size, because there's some massive players out there. And I knew that if I did a good job with this expansion and I had good clients, then I would be attractive to a buyer because I was off size. And when I was pretty close to that, I'll be honest, I reached out to a few people more like, hey, here's Octopi, here's where we are. If you're interested in co-packing or something else, let me know, kind of deal. And I just called a bunch of potential partners that I thought could be interesting to work with. And then Asahi was very interested and it just happened.
So you knew they were looking for a presence in the US, but did you think they were looking for a facility perhaps?
Well, literally why I emailed them was like the global CEO, Katsuki-san, basically said like, we want to be in North America. We don't have North America. And I was like, well, let me email Asahi. They're buying something in North America. Yeah. So I did follow what was written and then just called email the right person at Asahi. And it just started going from there. But they were serious. They said, and there was an article, I think yesterday, that they still said that, you know, like we want to be in the biggest market in the world, which is North America. And what I love also, he said, you know, I think it was like 40 or 50% of our production by 2040 has to be non-alcoholic, which is pretty incredible. Like very few global CEOs of, you know, spirits, beverage, beer companies are saying that, but he's saying that. So I think he has a very progressive view on the market.
Well, the deal was announced at the start of this year. Can you kind of tell us where things stand between y'all in integration and where things are?
Yeah, like the integration process, I'll be honest, it's going to take about a year plus. It's on track. We have a ton of work to do. You know, it's a big company, but they've been fantastic to work with. You know, very easy, great people. I would say like they're the best people we've worked with by far. And I'm not just saying that because they bought us. Like they truly are. They truly care. And they're great. But it's going to take us about a year to get to the standards that they need. So even though we have, I would say, incredible standards for the U.S., the standards of the Japanese are above anybody else in North America. So they really want to make sure that we're like perfect to produce their product. They care that much about Asahi Super Dry. So we still have a long way to go, but we're on track according to the process.
And can you share any short-term goals on, you know, where you and Asahi plan to be with production maybe over the coming years?
Yeah. So a little difference between like a Japanese buyer than any other buyer, like they're very long-term, which was a breath of fresh air because for us was all go, 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 grow, grow, grow. Whether Asahi is like, no, here's a 10-year plan. Here's the next 3-year plan. So we want to produce Q1 of 2025. That is the goal. The first product that we want to roll off the line is Asahi Super Dry for the US market. But they have 5 global brands. So it's Peroni. They own it globally, not in the US, but we're going to produce Peroni here for Canada, for example. Kozel, which is a phenomenal Czech brand. Don't tell them that, but it's probably my favorite brand that they produce. Pilsner Urquell, but nobody can produce it except in Pilsner right now. And then, of course, Asahi Super Dry and Grolsch. So all those global brands except Pilsner Urquell we're going to produce. And, of course, some other regional brands that they also own. But it's going to be a slow ramp up, starting production in 2025, 2026, full production in 2027.
Jen, you want to?
Yeah. I've got some questions. Hey, Isaac, how are you doing? Say hi halfway through. Fascinating story. And, you know, I'm curious too, what does Asahi see as the value of the contract and beyond obviously you guys producing their brand? Do they also find your other contracts as valuable to, I don't know, R&D or anything else? I mean, how do they see that?
Yeah, I think, contract is still a good business. So that's, you know, also they bought us because we were making money and we're growing. What I loved about Asahi was like, you keep doing what you're doing, keep contracting, keep growing contracting, keep getting clients. We're going to add to what you do our brands. And it's going to be an addition, not a replacement. Mm-hmm. So the good news is that the whole team stays. I stay and I love what I do. And then we keep contract and they see it as a benefit because like I said, it's a good business. And then also one of the reasons they bought us is that they want to learn from us or from the US market and ideally bring it back to Europe, where I would say innovation's a little bit behind, but not in Japan. Japan is super ahead of innovation. So the division that bought us is Asahi Europe and International, AEI, which is part of the European division. And that's who we talk to and, you know, my bosses there, et cetera, and who we report to. But I think they brought us to learn about, you know, all of the innovation we do and bring it back to the European division.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And you probably get this one a lot, but how would you compare and contrast this deal to like the Stone and Sapporo deal that happened a couple years ago?
Sure. I'll be honest. I know very little about those other deals. You know, they bought brands, but for us, they didn't buy a brand because we don't have any brand. They bought an asset. They bought a great asset located in the right place with the right equipment, with the right capabilities and the potential for growth. So like I said, they bought a business and on top of that, they're adding their brands.
Right, right. Yeah. And you said 20% of what you guys do is beer these days?
Yes.
What's the vast majority of the other BevAlc that y'all produce? Is it RTDs, FMBs, or?
Non-alcoholic, like CSD, carbonated soft drinks. Yeah.
Okay.
55% of production is CSDs, energy drinks, and the likes.
Okay.
Yeah. So our where we specialize is in canned product mainly, alcoholic, non-alcoholic, carbonate or steel below 4.6 pH. And the pH is very important because anything below 4.6 pH, we can kill with flash and tunnel pasteurization. Anything above 4.6 pH, that's either retort or aseptic, which we don't do. So it's very, very clearly defined in the beverage world, the type of products you can produce depending on that pH.
And it sounds like everybody's very interested in more non-alc options that play in the alc occasion. Is there anything you can say toward that?
Yeah, like, you know, we've all seen the growth of non-alcoholic beer. It's the, I would say, the biggest, it's still tiny in the US, but it's growing pretty significantly in terms of percentages. I think that's still going to be very interesting to go, but, you know, you've seen the rise of the mocktails or the adaptogenic flavors, or somebody that wants to drink something really flavorful but doesn't have the calories or the alcohol. So we definitely see a trend growing. I definitely see there's completely differences between the regions in the world. I think the US is way ahead of innovation, but not on percentage of consumption. You know, like some place in Europe, you've heard it a million times, you know, they have 20-25% is non-alcoholic products or beer. But I do see that, you know, it's legit, right? Like the younger generation's drinking less. They're not drinking that much alcohol. Every, you know, beer and wine and spirits, they're all declining, or they've been declining for a few years. You know, COVID came a big bump, but they're going down. But I would say it's definitely a trend. And, you know, Japan mainly, you know, you've seen in the news, Japan, younger generation is not drinking or drinking less. And we've seen some reports of the government encouraging people to drink.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. So like I said, depending on where you go, but what is for sure guaranteed is the younger generation is drinking less.
Crazy. So do you think that the U.S., can you see a day from, based on what you're seeing, where the U.S. does look more like Europe in terms of percentage of non-alc bev drinkers?
I don't know if for NA beer, like my guess, and again, I've been wrong a million times, that maybe NA beer will get to like 5% of the market.
Yeah.
I don't see it getting to 20-25%, but definitely people moving into like non-alcoholic categories. We've seen it, right? Like the really amazing stories of the Celsius of the world, the Olipops of the world, you know, those products that are growing incredibly significant. We're going to see more of that for sure.
Yeah. And then just one more from me, you know, in terms of, and I think you kind of hinted at it, but it sounds like Asahi wants to broaden its footprint in terms of also what it owns in the US.
Yeah.
Any idea what you guys are looking for generally?
In terms of what?
In terms of future sort of partnerships or acquisitions
for
in the US. Yeah, which I mean, I figured you'd be privy to, kind of.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I have zero preview. And if you ask Asahi, they'll say the same thing. The only person that might have preview is the head of M&A, who doesn't even tell the Asahi people unless it's a done deal. But again, like the CEO has said that they've really lowered their debt. They are in acquisition mode. And I would be shocked if they don't acquire something in the next, you know, 1 or 2 years.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's going to be in US, but they've said they want to do more M&A.
There's been quite a few Japanese brewers kind of betting big on the US. Where do you see Japanese beers going in the States? And how do they kind of, you think, break out of the mold of this kind of like singular dining occasion and kind of get into more drinking occasions?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'll be honest, Asahi Super Dry is a phenomenal beer. And I think it has a very strong position in the ethnic Japanese market. But I think it can grow to more than that, right? You know, they've got incredible like partnerships with Manchester City, the soccer club in the UK, and they sponsored the Rugby World Cup last year. So there's more awareness. And, you know, Pironi Worldwide just launched a partnership with Ferrari. So I think those global partnerships are going to bring more eyes to the brand. The brand and the product is phenomenal. Like, I'll be honest, like it's one of the most technically difficult beers to make that we've ever done. The flavor is great. Like it gives that like big hour of flavor, and then it dissipates really quickly, which is aside super dry. And the goal is now for our marketing team and our sales team to deliver and really push the brand in the US. But again, kind of like paraphrasing what the global CEO said is we want two top 10 brands, worldwide brands. You know, Peroni is already 10. Asahi Super Dry is number 12. We can't be a top 10 brand without being the biggest market, which is the US. So I think that's the reason that they're focusing here.
And then I just want to talk a little bit too about just, you know, being a big beverage co-packer. And I think we were kind of talking about trends, but, you know, I feel like you have a front row seat to, like, you know, all the latest happenings. What are some trends you see kind of in the beverage space, and what are some things that are maybe falling out of favor?
Yeah. So I think you very similar to what you've seen, right? You know, the hard seltzer is kind of done, dominated, of course, by Wacker. They've done an amazing job, Mark Anthony, with keeping actually growing the category. But I think, you know, the new entrants are kind of like done. I think the RTD is following the same thing. A ton of new entrants, High Noon, Cutwater, and then the rest trying to get a little piece. For next trends, well, we're seeing right now the non-alcoholic products, like the Good For You products, the sodas, etc. They're seeing a huge growth potential. But coming up next, I don't know. We'll see. The trends come and go really fast. Me personally, this is not a sake. But I think the hemp and CBD Delta 9 kind of world could be a big one, but it's not going to happen until it gets federally legalized, which could take anywhere from 3 to 5 years or more. But that's, for me, one of them that I know it'll happen. I just don't know when. I think the value proposition of a THC product is phenomenal. I think it can travel masses, but I don't think it'll grow until it gets federally legalized, or if it gets federally legalized. But the next one right now, TBD. I don't think anybody knows. We're all trying different things. The good news about a co-packing is that I don't have to sell it. I just produce it. And it works great. Yeah.
I meant to ask this earlier, but you guys don't do any D9 beverages, right?
No. A part of the Saki deal was that we're not allowed to do any of that anymore.
You used to. Okay. That's interesting. Obviously, to your point, federal legalization needs to happen for even intoxicating hemp stuff for it to be, you know, for the three-tier system to be really comfortable with it, right? And for it to thus take off. But do you see in some ways, to me a little bit, it's almost like hard seltzer, right? Because even without that, it's already seems like it's shooting up, right? And so if the faster it shoots up, maybe the faster it contracts. Do you, just personally, with everything you've seen, do you think there's a danger of that? Or
yeah, it could be, but, you know, like I'll sell you like a D9 or a THC, right? Value proposition for me, which I've said it many times, was you're going to drink two cans.
Yeah.
You're going to get a nice buzz. You're going to have fun. You're going to laugh. You're going to drink 40 calories. And then the next day, zero hangover. So like, why wouldn't you do that, right? So I think it's a really good replacement for alcoholic products. But again, it's going to take time. It's not going to happen until it gets federally legalized. You know, some chains are picking it up, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But it could be a flash in the pan like that. I don't think so. I think this is going to stay. I think the products are, you know, some of the stuff that's out there is pretty good. But again, it's not going to gain major traction until it gets done. And maybe 20 years from now, that'll be, you know, 20% of the market. Who knows?
Yeah. One more I wanted to ask. I'm curious, you know, how has the perception of contract brewing or co-packing kind of changed in your time as one? What have you seen since, you know, those early days to now? With 100%. Suppliers, consumers.
Yeah. So when we opened, contract brewing had a pretty negative connotation. Contract brewing was bad, bad quality, bad this, bad everything. And literally, I opened Octopi to change the narrative. I'm like, I'm going to show that contract brewing is phenomenal because I'm going to focus on quality and quality and quality. And I'm also going to care about my client, because when I started, I would have to beg the contract brewers to make my product. I would have to beg them to give me any product. They would give me horrible pricing and I didn't have anything. And I'm like, I'm going to change all that. And I think today, I think contract brewing has zero negative connotation. I actually think it's positive. You know, all the big guys are doing it. Every big beverage company is co-packing something somewhere. You know, I'll tell you a fun story. Like our our we were the first co-packer that Anheuser-Busch chose ever in North America with a small project. And I think right now they have, you know, but at the time they didn't have any division, et cetera. Now there's like a full co-packing division that manages all the co-packers. So that, I think that trend has completely changed. And I think co-packing's very, very good and well seen. And, you know, some of the big companies are really good at making this, but when they want to innovate, they're not really good. So that's where the co-packers exist, to make products that, you know, the big facilities don't want to make or can't make.
You know, just wrapping up, what is next for, you know, Octopi itself? Are you still taking on more contract partners? Are there any new capabilities you're looking to bring on? And, you know, how long before?
Yeah, so we are still taking clients for, like, for some, right now we're looking at clients for 2025. We're always looking for great clients to work with. You know, our mantra, and now with Asahi, has always been like, let's take 1 to 2 clients a year. We don't want 100 clients. We just want 1 to 2 really good clients a year. For innovation, you know, Asahi is putting a significant amount of CapEx to make sure that we can produce, of course, their brands, but there's going to be some equipment that we can use for other stuff. The biggest capability we added recently is nitrogen generation for steel products. So I would say we have the best nitrogen steel product capability in the market right now. You know, our TPO, DO specs, this is total package oxygen or dissolved oxygen in the can, is I would say the best in the market. So we're really, really proud and focused on that. And we're looking to add more stuff. I know there's a new packaging line coming up, hopefully in 2025. So I'm excited about that too.
Well, Isaac, that was great. Thank you so much. Jen, you have anything else you want to add?
No, that was super, super amazing, insightful. Yeah, I know you've had a long career in the industry and you've been doing a lot of interesting things. I mean, you basically raised the bar for contract brewing in the US, which is no small feat. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Huge fan of everything you guys do. So I appreciate the invite and looking forward to seeing what else we can do.
Absolutely.
Sweet. Us too.
Thank you.
See ya.
Cheers.